this tie-dyed, sleeveless t-shirt that he wears all the time. It's yellow with a big red P on it. The P is made to look like blood, and he tells people it is blood.
You think it is? Letty asked.
Looks like regular tie-dye to me, kind of faded out. She turned back to Lucas. Mr. Davenport, Pilot is full of shit. He's a liar, and he's lazy, and he's crazy, and he sells dope, but that doesn't mean that he doesn't do some of the stuff he says he does. I know for sure that they have all these food stamp cards, and they sell them for money at these crooked stores in L.A. They've been running that scam for a couple of years. He talks about how the fall is coming, and how the only way to survive will be to join up with the outlaws. And you gotta be willing to kill in cold blood. They've got guns and everything.
The fall?
Yeah, you know, when everything blows up and all the survivors wear camo and drive around in jeeps.
Lucas and Letty threw questions at her for 15 minutes, and when they were done, they had character sketches of Pilot and four of his disciples, named Kristen, Linda, Belle, and Raleigh. No last names.
Raleigh plays a guitar, and Pilot calls him Sledge, like a combination of Slash and Edge. And Kristen used a steel file to sharpen her teeth into points, and she's like inked from head to toe, Sky said, but she had few hard facts.
She knew that Pilot's group traveled in a caravan of old cars, including at least one RV, and she thought they'd been hassled by the South Dakota Highway Patrol at some point, because Henry, before he disappeared, but after he spotted Pilot at the rally, said they never stopped talking about it.
They had all kind of drugs in their cars, and they almost got busted by a South Dakota Highway Patrolman, but they didn't because the cop was on his way home for dinner.
That sounds real enough, Letty said, glancing at Lucas. In the end, Lucas said, All right, you've got me interested. Let me take a look at the guy. I need to know Henry's full name, and it would be good if we could get the license plate numbers on Pilot's vehicles.
It's Henry Mark Fuller, and he's from Johnson City, Texas. He went to Lyndon B. Johnson High School, but I think he dropped out in 11th grade. I don't know any license plate numbers.
Lucas wrote Henry's name in his notebook and then said, If you ever see any of Pilot's people, take down the license plate numbers if you have a chance. That can get us a lot of information. If you run into friends you trust, ask them to keep an eye out.
I will.
If Pilot was ever in serious trouble, where would I most likely find a police report? Lucas asked. Sky considered that for a moment, then said,
I heard that he was originally from Louisiana somewhere, but he claimed that he was an actor in Los Angeles for a long time. I think Los Angeles. I don't know where in Louisiana.
Letty asked, Will you see any more travelers here?
I think so. The St. Paul cops are mellower than the Minneapolis cops, so people come here and hang out in Sweet Hollow. I've been there a couple times.
You can walk there from the hotel, Lucas said. He said, Check around, but don't be too obvious about it. Don't ask about Pilot, ask about Henry. Mostly, just listen.
I can do that, Sky said. I've been asking about Henry everywhere.
Letty didn't want to end the interview there, so they all drove back to the house, where Letty borrowed the SUV to take Skye to a laundromat. I'll drop her at the Holiday Inn after we finish with her clothes, Letty told Lucas. Meet you back here. Lucas went on downtown in his Porsche, made calls to friends in Los Angeles, and talked to one of his agents, Virgil Flowers, who had good connections in South Dakota, and then ran a database search on Pilot as a known alias. Oddly enough, nothing came up. Lucas had been under the impression that almost any noun in the dictionary had been, at one time or another, given to the cops as a fake name. Flowers called back with the name of a South Dakota Highway Patrol officer working out of Pierre, and when Lucas called him, he said he'd put out a statewide request for information based on Lucas's description of the caravan. Lucas especially wanted license plate numbers.
"Won't take long," the cop said, "unless whoever saw them is off duty and offline. I'll call you one way or another."
Lucas also asked him to put out a stop and hold on a Henry Mark Fuller of Johnson City, Texas. Late in the day, he got a call from a lieutenant in the L.A. Special Operations Bureau who said he should call an intelligence cop named Lewis Hall in Santa Monica. Lucas did, and Hall said,
"You're looking for a guy named Pilot?
We're interested in him. Don't know where to look. He apparently travels with a band of followers in a bunch of beat-up old cars and an RV. Some of the women with him may be turning tricks."
"Yeah, I know about that guy. I've seen him a couple of times," Hall said.
"Never talked to him. Somebody would come in and say that he'd heard that Pilot had a satanic ritual somewhere. I'm not real big on tracking down satanic rituals, since they usually involve people who know the governor."
"I hear you," Lucas said. "Any indication of violence? I mean, specific reports?"
"Nothing specific. Rumors," Hall said. "I know they used to hang out in Venice for a while. I know some people down there I could ask."
"If you get the time, I'd appreciate it," Lucas said. "He supposedly says he's an actor."
"What did he do?"
"I kinda hate to tell you because it sounds like more bullshit. We have a traveler here who says she was told that Pilot cut out her boyfriend's heart and keeps it in a mason jar."
Hall laughed and said,
"You must have some extra time on your hands."
"You know what? If I were in your shoes, I'd have said the same thing. But this girl we have here, this traveler, she's sort of convincing."
"Uh-oh."
"Okay, I'll see who I can round up in Venice and get back to you. Lord knows we've got enough really weird assholes around here."
"Thanks, I know you're busy. If we hear anything at all, either up or down, I'll call you," Lucas said.
"Wait, you've got nothing more to go on? Nothing that would point me in any particular direction?"
"No. I've been doing database searches and I can't find a single person with a Pilot alias. I'm wondering if I should start checking airports." Another couple seconds of silence from the other end, then Hall said,
The guy I'm talking about, it's not Pilot like airplane pilot, it's Pilot like Pontius Pilot. You know, the guy who did whatever he did to Jesus?"
"What?"
"Yeah. P-I-L-A-T-E, not Pilot. P-I-L-O-T.
"Ah, poop. Back to the databases," Lucas said. Hall laughed again.
"Good luck with that."
Lucas went back to the databases, and Pilot popped up immediately, and twice, once in Arkansas and once in Arizona. The Arkansas hit was tied to a man whose real name was Rezin Carter, who had a long rap sheet that started in 1962, when Carter was 12. Too old for Pilot, who Sky had said was probably in his early 30s. The second was a traffic stop on I-10 in Quartzsite, Arizona, 6 years earlier. The driver had no license or any other ID. He said he had bought his car for $500 in Phoenix and was trying to get to Los Angeles, where he had the promise of an acting job. He gave his name as Porter Pilot. The cop who'd stopped him had given him a ticket and had the car towed to a local commercial impoundment lot that had several dozen cars inside. At 1 o'clock the next morning, the night man at the impoundment lot had a pistol stuck in his face by a man wearing a cowboy bandana as a mask. The night man was tied up and left on the floor of his hut. Keys to the impounded cars weren't available because they were in a drop safe, and the night man didn't have the key. Nevertheless, the gunman drove away a few minutes later. The night man couldn't see which car was taken, but an inventory the next morning indicated that the 1998 Pontiac Sunfire, driven by Porter Pilot, was gone, which was the only reason a routine traffic stop showed up in Lucas's database, on a warrant for armed robbery. The Sunfire was later located after it was towed in Venice, California, a week after it disappeared in Quartzsite. Both the Arizona and California cops listed the same license tag, which tracked back to a man named Ralph Benson, a professional bowler from Scottsdale, Arizona, who said he'd left his car in the long-term parking at Sky Harbor Airport. It had two keys in a magnetic holder under the rear bumper. When contacted by L.A. cops, he declined to travel to Los Angeles to retrieve the car, which he said wasn't worth the trip. The car was eventually sent to a recycling yard, and that was the end of it. Porter Pilot. Lucas ran the full name through the database and came up with nothing except the Arizona hit. He called the Arizona Highway Patrol and found that the cop who'd issued the ticket had retired, but they had a phone number. The cop was in a swimming pool, and his wife took a phone out to him.
"I do remember that guy, because of the robbery that night," the cop said. "He was like an advertisement for an asshole, if you'll excuse the expression. You know, wife-beater t-shirt, smelled like sweat, black hair and half-assed cornrows."
"White guy?"
"Yeah. Dark complexion, but sort of dark reddish. No accent, sounded native-born. Had some prison ink, one of those weeping Jesuses on his shoulder. Crown of thorns with blood running down. From that, you might have thought he was a Mexican gangster, but he wasn't."
"No ID at all?"
"None. Not a single piece of paper. Gave him a ticket and he signed it. After the robbery, we went back to the ticket to see if he'd left prints, but there was nothing there but mine. Of course, we didn't have the car. When they found it in California, we asked them to process it, but it wasn't a priority. When they finally got around to it, turned out it had been wiped."
That was it.
Lucas thanked the cop, said it must be nice to be in a pool, and the cop said it was 108 on his patio. "It's not so much nice as a matter of survival." Lucas called the South Dakota Highway Patrolman, gave him the new name and the details, and then the L.A. cop, who said the Arizona pilot sounded like the pilot he'd seen. Lucas closed up and went home. Letty was out somewhere, and the housekeeper had taken Sam to Whole Foods, and the baby was asleep, and Weathers said that her back had been feeling grimy, probably from the hot weather. Lucas took her up to the shower and washed her back, thoroughly enough that she wouldn't really need another back washing for some time. Lucas was getting himself back together when Shrake called.
"I talked to your guy, Wilfred. He said some college dropouts were making a supercomputer in a barn somewhere, but he doesn't know what for. But they're paying $50 for any computer in any shape, as long as it has a certain kind of processor. I don't know shit about computers, but have you ever heard of something called Sandy Bridge or Ivy Bridge?"
"That rings a bell," Lucas said.
"I think it might be some kind of Intel chip."
"Okay. Anyway, they're paying $50 cash money. As I understand it, those chips cost a few $100 each. The cash money aspect means that every asshole with legs is over at the university stealing computers. They met at a park-and-ride lot last week down in Denmark Township, and the story is people had 1,000 computers. Not all of them had the right chip, but most of them did. These guys paid out a shitload of money and left in a white Ford F-150 with no plates."
"When you say 1,000, is that a guess that means a lot, or does that mean 1,000?
"I asked that. Wilfred actually thought it might have been more than 1,000. The buyers had a laptop with a list of every computer in the world on it, and you'd step up with your computer, and they'd tell you yes or no, and if it was yes, they'd peel a 50 off a roll and throw the computer in the back of the truck. When he said throw, that's what he meant, He said they'd just toss it in the back, didn't care what happened to the video screens.
Will there be another meeting?
I'm told there will be, but it might not be around here. The rumor is these guys are from Iowa and they've been buying all over the Midwest. Wilfred will keep an eye out. Supposedly, these guys need 16,384 processors. That's the number Wilfred gave me, and he claims it's exact.
Ah, Jesus.
Oh, he said the buyers had guns.
Ah, Jesus.
Letty was back at dinner time. Lucas told her what he'd found out about Pilot, and she asked, "What do you think now?"
Sky has me interested. There is no doubt that hundreds of people are murdered every year and their bodies are never found, Lucas said. I could even tell you where a lot of them are. If you took a search team out in the desert south of Las Vegas and searched for a mile on both sides of the highway down to San Bernardino, you'd turn up 100 bodies without looking too hard. The most likely victims are like Sky, because nobody ever really knows where they're at or where they might have gone to. If you had a serious, insane predator out there, a crazy guy, travelers are natural targets. If this guy Pilot is really like she says he is, he could be dangerous, Letty said.
Good. You're interested. That's all I wanted,
Weather said.
Letty, I'm begging you. Don't hang out with Sky. Let her do her own thing. You'd stick out like a sore thumb, and the word would get around that you're affluent and you could get in pretty deep trouble, even without Pilot.
I'd be okay if I had a carry permit.
Lucas opened his mouth, maybe to scream, but she grinned and said,
Just messing with you, Dad.
After dinner, Letty called the Holiday Inn, Sky's room, but she wasn't in. She was in at 8 o'clock and said she'd had no luck talking to other travelers in St. Paul. Letty asked about the Jesus tattoo on Pilot's shoulder, and Sky said that she knew Pilot had some ink, but not the specifics. Otherwise, the description of the man in quartzite fit the man she knew. When Lucas told Sky that the guy's name was Pilot, A-T-E, not Pilot, O-T, she said,
I don't think that's right, Mr. Davenport. He didn't tell people his name was Pilot. He said, The Pilot, like a title, not like a name.
All right. I'll keep looking under both names. You keep asking around, Lucas said. We'll either find him or Henry, okay?
I hope, she said.
But Lucas heard the doubt in her voice. 3. For a father and daughter who had no blood relationship, Lucas and Letty not only looked alike, dark hair, blue eyes, athletic, but behaved alike, especially when it came to sleep. Both could stay up all night, neither liked to get up early. At 10:30, Lucas was up and had picked out a suit, was wearing the slacks and a t-shirt, and was considering the dress shirt possibilities when Letty knocked on the door to the bedroom suite.
Yeah, come on in, Lucas called from the dressing room.
Letty came in holding her phone.
I didn't hear the phone go off, but Sky left a message. She said that early this morning she went out to Swede Hollow and met a guy who said that Henry is up in Duluth with some other travelers, Letty said. She said she was going to catch a bus and go there. I called back to the hotel, but they said she'd checked out. I called the bus station, and they said a bus to Duluth left a half hour ago. She doesn't have a cell phone.
Do not go to Duluth, Lucas said.
I'm not going to. I don't expect you to either, but it was, I don't know, an anticlimax. I thought we might be getting somewhere yesterday, and now she's gone.
She's a traveler, Lucas said. I suspect she'll be back in touch. He slipped a shirt off a hanger, held it next to the suit jacket he'd be wearing, said, Good, and put it on and started buttoning it up.
In case you're not getting this, I'm a little concerned, Letty said.
So am I, but I'm not freaking out, Lucas said. I've still got some lines out on this pilot character, and we'll see what we see. When she finds Henry, she'll call back, and we'll see what she has to say then.
All right.
Well, I've got things to do today. I'm hooking up with Carrie and Jeff. We're going over to the U to hang out.
Don't worry too much, Lucas said. He held up a tie. What do you think?
I would never advise you on ties any more than Mom would, Letty said. You're better at it than we are.
That's true, Lucas said. He looked in his tie drawer, then settled on his original choice.
I'll call if anything comes in on Henry, or on Pilot.
Letty left, and Lucas stood in front of the mirror to tie his necktie. As he did it, he mused on what he'd almost said to her. He'd almost said, "Take your phone with you." Of course she'd take her phone with her. She was never more than 15 feet from it. She'd eventually have it epoxied to the palm of her hand. Not necessarily a bad thing, he thought. Women had been on the verge of taking over the world, the Western world anyway. Then some sexist pig in Silicon Valley invented the cell phone, and women took a sidetrack on which all 4 billion of them would soon be happily talking to each other 24 hours a day, getting nothing else done, and men would be back. He whistled a few bars from Lyle Lovett's Don't Touch My Hat and checked himself in the mirror. He looked terrific. Not that any women would notice. They'd be too busy talking to each other on their fucking cell phones. When Lucas got to the office, a few minutes after 11 o'clock, he had a voicemail from the South Dakota cop. They'd been through a full shift cycle with the patrol. All officers had been queried about Pilot's caravan, and there'd been no responses.
If I hear anything, I'll call you.
He also had an email note from the L.A. cop, Lewis Hall. Call me. The email had come in at 10, 8 o'clock L.A. time, so Hall had been up early. Lucas called him back.
Listen, I talked to some of the rough trade down in Venice last night, and your boy Pilot could be a problem, Hall said. I may even owe you. I talked to a guy who's been around the beach for 20 years, runs a massage place. He says there was a rumor that Pilot knows about the Kitty Place murder. I don't know if you heard about that.
I heard something. I don't know the details, Lucas said.
Kitty was an entertainer. I don't know what you'd say. Not a hooker or anything. She'd get small parts in movies. She had lines now and then. She had a SAG card, and she was doing some stand-up work. She had an apartment down on Main Street in Santa Monica.
What's a SAG card?
She was in the Screen Actors Guild. Sort of a big deal out here, getting a card. Means you're recognized as a human being. Anyway, she was putting that kind of life together. Then one day, about a year ago, she turned up dead. Found her floating in the water off Marina Del Rey. She'd been slashed to pieces, tortured with a knife, raped. Pretty goddamn awful, even for L.A.
DNA?
No. She'd been in the water for a while, so we never got good DNA, and we never got a whiff of who might have done it. No current boyfriend. Her former boyfriend seemed like a decent guy, and he had a solid alibi. He was playing trumpet up in Vegas all through that period. I was talking to my boy Reuben last night, and he mentioned that sometime, some fairly long time after the body came up, he heard that some people thought she might have been tied up with this Pilot. I talked to the homicide guys this morning, and nobody had ever mentioned Pilot to them.
Does Reuben know where Pilot used to hang, or who he'd hang with? Lucas asked.
If I could get car tags, we could probably run him down. He was supposedly in Sturgis, South Dakota, at the biker rally last week, probably heading east. The trouble is, we don't have any solid ID,
No solid photo, no real history. Nothing we can use to get our hands on him. He claims he's been in the movies. You think he'd have a SAG card?
I could check. I got the impression from Reuben, and I'm not sure how much Reuben really knows. He tends to talk bigger than he is. But I got the impression that Pilot's a street guy. Moves around a lot, lives here and there, and sometimes out of his car, sells a little weed. Reuben thinks he had a girlfriend named Kay, like the letter K, and she might still be around. I'll try to run her down today.
I'd appreciate anything you could get me, Lucas said.
Not just for you anymore.
Kitty Place was a very pretty blonde, a vulnerable-looking kind, and a really nice girl. When she got all slashed up, the shit hit the media fan around here. The homicide guys want me to push it. They'd give their left nuts for a break. A good break wouldn't do me any harm either.
All right, call me if you hear anything, and if I get anything, I'll call you.
Talk to you,
Hall said. Del Capslock limped in the door, carrying his cane. Lucas said, good thing you got that cane to hold you up.
It's becoming a, shit, I was about to say, crutch.
He sat down and said,
I talked to Honey Potts. She's interested. I talked to Daisy Jones. She's interested, too. I told Honey that we'd fix up a letter saying that we wouldn't prosecute if she changed her story and remembered something different, as long as she didn't perjure herself.
Again, Lucas said.
Yeah, again. Jenkins was doing his cynical guy act, told her that if she really thought Marion was going to share the take with her, she was crazy. She'd only get a cut if he was acquitted, and once he was acquitted, he couldn't be tried again. Then he'd have no reason to pay her off. Jenkins asked her, does she really want to hang out with a guy who murdered his wife by beating her to death? He suggested that kind of thing tends to become a habit.
She bought it.
I'm not sure, but Daisy is going to talk to her tonight, see if she'll do an interview.
Daisy Jones was a longtime reporter for WCCO Television, known for her confessional talks with Twin Cities celebrities who'd managed to step on their dicks. Lucas said, worth a shot.
Hey, if she says she was banging Marion after he married Gloria, I think we're better than 50-50.
Maybe. But it'd be nice to get one more thing, Lucas said. Anything on Corey?
As a matter of fact, there is.
Del stood and put two hands against the wall and stretched his bad leg, bouncing on it. He'd been shot up by elderly gunrunners the year before and had gone through four operations trying to get things straight. He now had so much metal in his pelvis that he carried a TSA notification card just to get on an airplane. Despite the lingering disability, he'd gone back to full-time in April. He sat back down again.
I found Brett Givens working as a sign man for a real estate dealership over in Edina, he said. He drives a pickup, goes around putting up signs or taking them down.
Lucas knew Givens. Better than working at the chop shop.
Yeah. Anyway, he says Corey is definitely back because he saw him up in Cambridge last week, at Kenyon's. He said Corey didn't see him because he ducked out. I think he was afraid that Corey might try to talk him into something. He likes the sign job.
Givens didn't know where Corey's living.
No. But he said there were random people in the bar who seemed to know Corey, like he might be a regular. He said Corey doesn't look especially prosperous, so he might still have the safe. I thought I'd go up this afternoon, have a few beers.
All right. Take care. Jenkins and Shrake are out of pocket. If you need backup, call me, and I'll either come up or get John to send somebody. Dale Corey was believed to be in possession of a safe that contained $2 million in diamond jewelry at wholesale prices, taken from a jewelry store in St. Paul on the night of New Year's Day. The store's owner had been confident in the safety of his jewelry because the safe he kept it in was made of hardened steel, weighed as much as a Hummer, and was kept in a room made of concrete block. He hadn't counted on somebody backing a wrecker through the front wall of the store and the concrete block wall, throwing a cinch chain around the safe, lifting it straight up, and then hauling butt. He hadn't counted on it because the idea seemed so goddamn stupid. The wrecker had been stolen and was found behind a supermarket 8 blocks from the jewelry store, where the cops also found in the fresh snow the tread marks from an 18-wheeler. Where it went, they didn't know, but by the end of the week, there were rumors that tied Corey to the job. A couple of weeks later, there were also rumors that Corey couldn't get the safe open, which made him something of a laughingstock among Twin City lowlifes. The jeweler was not laughing. His safe had been so good that his insurance loss ceiling was lower than it should have been, much lower. He got a third of the wholesale price back from Chubb, and that was it. He called Lucas once a week to ask about his safe. Dell took off, and Lucas started working through the rest of the caseload. A lot of it was more a matter of coordination than investigation, keeping the various suburban police departments up to date on who was doing what and who was looking for whom. Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Bloomington could generally take care of themselves and had their own liaisons. Lucas's current priorities included 2 armed robbers, one who specialized in credit union branches, and another who scouted out and then hit businessmen who were taking money home on Sunday nights after business hours when they couldn't run it out to a bank during the day. The credit union guy was careful, and while he claimed to be armed, he never showed a gun. Lucas thought they'd probably get him if he didn't move out of town, and wasn't overly worried that he'd shoot someone. He seemed too careful. The other guy, he thought, would eventually kill someone. He was almost certainly an ex-con and didn't carry a gun. Instead, he carried a pipe. He was a big guy dealing with businessmen who so far had all been elderly. He used the pipe for intimidation. One of the old guys had fought him and had gotten an arm broken for his trouble. Sooner or later, Lucas thought, the thief would smack somebody in the head and then they'd be looking for a killer if the cops didn't get him first. All of that was important, and it bored him. So did the U.S. Secret Service. Somebody in town was passing exceptional copies of $50 and $100 bills, and there was some evidence that the currency was coming in from Lebanon. The Secret Service had 3 agents poking around, and they generally considered the BCA to be their assistants in the matter, sort of like secretaries, or maybe receptionists, or maybe golden retrievers. Lucas had been the latest designated BCA liaison, and he'd eventually handled the Secret Service information requests, which always arrived by email, by referring them to his shared secretary, who was told to do the best she could. Her best sometimes involved the wastebasket. Jenkins called.
Shrake and I hooked up for a beer, and we got to thinking.
Uh-oh, that's not recommended.
I know, we try to avoid it when we can, but we'd like to stop by later and talk.
Come ahead, I'm mostly sitting on my thumb. Letty called him late in the day. She was back home and hadn't heard from Sky. Lucas hadn't heard from Hall in L.A., and had gotten busy with a flurry of phone calls when another credit union went down. Turned out not to be the guy he was looking for, and never called Hall back. Letty was unhappy with the lack of movement, but Lucas asked, "What should we do? We're not getting anything. I suspect that Sky and Henry have hooked up and moved on."
"She should have called," Letty said.
Lucas shrugged, though there was nobody around to see it.
"She's a traveler, like you said. She doesn't have a cell."
Shrake and Jenkins came in. Jenkins did the talking.
One of the problems with the Marion case is that we could never produce the club.
Probably burned it, Lucas said.
Probably not. Takes too long, and he was on a tight schedule. We know he didn't burn it in the home fireplace because crime scene checked it, did samples, and said the last fire was a long time ago. And Marion had to drive like hell to get up to his cabin before Gloria's daughter came home and found the body. The fireplace at the cabin was gas, not wood, so he didn't burn it there.
So?
What we're thinking is he whacked Gloria in the bathroom, threw her down the stairs, pinched off her nose and mouth, wiped up the bathroom floor with that foaming bubble stuff, jumped in his car and took off.
Nobody saw him, Lucas said. Because Sunfish Lake is darker than the black hole of Calcutta, and he's up on that ridge. He looks out the window to make sure nobody is coming down that little road, then he jumps in the car and takes off, Jenkins said. Once he's out of the house, who's going to see him or know who's in the car? Anyway, he goes up to the cabin, the club is in his trunk, carefully wrapped in something because he's no dummy. He gets up there knowing that the daughter could, at that point, get home any time and find the body. When that happens, he's going to have to drive back to Sunfish Lake right now, like a grieving husband should. So he gets to the cabin, still got the club, has to get rid of it. Can't burn it because it would take too long. It's dark. He goes out into the woods with a shovel. Some obscure spot, buries it. We're thinking probably in that vacant side lot. Not the front lawn, not between the cabin and the road, but in that empty lot, or maybe in the woods across the road. Doesn't need a deep pit. The club's only 2 inches in diameter. Carefully rakes some leaves over it, and it's gone. Or maybe he just threw it in a ditch on the way up, Lucas said. He's more careful than that. Throw it in a ditch, it could be found, Jenkins said. It's pretty distinctive, and it'd have some blood on it. So what you want to do is... We don't think he would have gone way deep in the woods, because he'd want to hear the phone ring. Remember... The daughter called him on the cabin phone, and then the cops called him on his cell, and they both put him up there. So we're thinking, we should go up there and mark out the likely spots and walk it inch by inch. Lucas thought about it and said, Say, aren't there a lot of golf courses around Cross Lake? Lucas, for Christ's sakes, we're trying to help out here, Jenkins said. What about the computer chips? Lucas asked Shrake. Those guys are long gone. We got the word out so people are watching for them, but we don't think they'll pop up here again. Not for a while, anyway. And the Marion trial is coming up. If you motherfuckers play more than one round a day...
Sky didn't call the next day either, or the next... On the morning of the fourth day, the South Dakota Highway Patrol guy called and asked, I threw away the note you gave me, but you were looking for a Henry Mark Fuller, correct?
That's my guy. You got him?
A body came up in Sheridan County. The DCI's got him. You need to talk to a guy named Bob Clemens. The word I get is that the body has been identified as Fuller.
Lucas took a few seconds to digest that and then asked, How long has he been dead?
I guess he looks like he's been down for a week or so. They'll be doing an autopsy today or tomorrow. Crime scene is out there now. I heard that it was really rough, what they did to him.
Lucas got a number for Clemens, called him, got him on his cell phone. Clemens was in rural Butte County, north of Sturgis, up in some piney hills, looking at the crime scene. Lucas explained who he was and why he'd been looking for Fuller.
We need to talk to that Sky, if you can find her, Clemens said. Doesn't look like a domestic, though, no way. This wasn't one guy cutting him up. This took at least two or three. That's why we're looking at the bikers or a group of people. And if you can track down this pilot...
Clemens said Fuller's body had been found by a couple of Indian kids who'd been out with 22s, shooting around the countryside. Whoever had buried Fuller had only gone down a couple of feet before they hit rock, and the body had been partly uncovered by coyotes.
What they did was, or what it looks like, is that they nailed him to a tree and then took their time cutting him up. We got the tree, signs of blood on the bark, no weapon. We got a few tracks, but we got nothing definitive. What might be a pair of Nike athletic shoes and a boot mark. There was a campfire right there, and fresh. We think it's related, but no way to tell for sure. There was some partly burned trash in the fire, food wrappers. We're processing those for fingerprints, but like I said, we're not sure it's related.
When you say he was cut up, do you mean dismembered?
No, slashed. Long cuts running all down his body. Looks like he was castrated, but we're not sure about that because that part of the body and the stomach area was worked over pretty good by the coyotes. His hands and arms were in good enough shape to take prints. That's how we got the quick ID. He was arrested in Johnson City, Texas for burglary 3 years ago. Fingerprinted. We got a hit in the first 10 minutes. We can still see the spike holes in his wrists, below the heels of his hands.
Pretty crude, Lucas said. Listen, there was a woman killed out in L.A. He told Clemens about the Kitty Place murder. I'm worried because both you and the L.A. guy used the word slashed. I'd like to see the autopsy photos of the wounds and have the L.A. homicide guys take a look.
We'll get them to you, Clemens said. You're the guy involved in that black hole case last year, right? The guy who got that female cop back?
Yeah, that was me, Lucas said.
Hell of a thing, Clemens said.
Lucas called Hall in L.A., told him about the find in South Dakota.
I'm gonna hook you up with the homicide guys, Hall said. This is something.
An L.A. homicide detective named Rick Robinson called Lucas back a few minutes later, and Lucas gave him the story. They're doing the autopsy later today. We should be able to get the raw digital photos right away. The South Dakota guy said he'd make it a priority. If you want to call him, I've got a number. He could send them directly to you.
Need to see him, Robinson said. Sounds like the same thing somebody did to Kitty Place. Long slashes across her body. She wasn't crucified or anything, though.
After he got off the line with Robinson, Lucas called Letty to tell her what had happened. His daughter was not a typical teenager. She'd seen violent death, up close and personal. She could handle the news about Henry. Letty.
Why did somebody say they'd seen Henry up in Duluth? It sounds to me like they were setting her up. They're afraid that she'll talk about Henry.
Dad, we've got to get up there.
I can go up there, Lucas said. You can stay here.
Dad, I'm not going to mess with you, but you sort of need me,
Letty said.
I've met some of these people, and I can talk to them when you just scare them. They don't like people like you.
Lucas said, if I put you on a bus home, you stay on the bus. I don't want you running around the countryside.
I'll come home, I will. I'll come home when you say so.
They drove up to Duluth that afternoon in Lucas's truck. Lucas called ahead to a friend on the Duluth police force and was told that they should check out Leif Erickson Park on the lake. Lucas got directions and they rolled into town a few minutes before 3 o'clock on a day that had been hot in the cities. In Duluth, an east wind off Lake Superior had kept things cool. They found a meter on East Superior Street, cut through a parking lot, and took a footbridge into the park. A few dozen people were scattered around the grassy lakefront, throwing frisbees, looking at the lake, or doing nothing at all.
They didn't see anybody who looked like a traveler, but they did see a uniformed cop, and they went that way, and Lucas pulled out his ID.
I never heard them called travelers, but we got some, the cop said.
He waved off to the north.
They got a spot up there, I don't know, maybe 10 minutes up the lake walk. There's a little beach up there. They sit around under the trees talking, mostly. Might smoke a little dope.
Lucas thanked him, and they went that way. Lucas had dressed down for the trip, in jeans and a golf shirt and a light nylon jacket to cover the gun, but still, Letty said, he looked like a cop.
And you look like a snotty college kid, Lucas said. Do not.
Where'd those jeans come from? Neiman Marcus?
I think I saw some Neiman Marcus on your Amex. Did not.
Neiman fucking Marcus, la-di-fucking-da.
Shut up.
A half dozen travelers were sitting in a lakeside copse. Two benches looked out over the lake toward the Wisconsin shore, where a green and rust-colored freighter was maneuvering in toward the docks. A couple of the travelers were smoking cigarettes. Lucas couldn't smell any weed. And two of them had tough-looking, medium-sized dogs that showed pit bull in the eyes. They really didn't look like street people, Lucas thought, although they obviously lived outdoors. They had big functional packs, wide-brimmed hats, wore heavy hiking boots, and a couple of them had 6-foot-long walking sticks. Their ages ranged from the late teens to the mid-40s. 2 were women, 4 were men. What they really looked like, he thought, were dusty long-distance walkers. Which they were. They all stirred restlessly when Lucas and Letty cut toward them, like leaves rippling in a light wind. Town people tended to stay away unless they were cops, and the big guy looked like a cop. When they came up, Lucas said, "We need to talk to you guys. I'm a state police officer, and this is my daughter. We're looking for a friend of ours, a traveler who might be in serious trouble." One of the men, probably in his 30s, sounded skeptical.
"Well, what's up, Doc?"
Lucas looked at Letty, and she took it. "We have a friend named Sky. I talked to her 4 days ago down in St. Paul. We met in San Francisco in June, when she was going through. She was traveling with a guy named Henry Mark Fuller from Texas. They were out in Sturgis at the motorcycle rally, and Henry disappeared. Somebody, she said another traveler, told her that he'd seen Henry here in Duluth, and she came up here to find him. But Henry was murdered near Sturgis. They just dug up his body. We're worried that the people who killed Henry might try to hurt Sky. They know her. She doesn't like them, and they might try to shut her up about Henry." Another stir rippled through the group. A man said, "Shit, somebody killed Henry?" And one of the women said, "We know Sky. We knew Henry. I haven't seen him since we were in Eugene, but we were going to meet up in Hayward, Wisconsin next weekend. There's a juggalo gathering. We're all going to that." Lucas said, "You're juggalos?" One of the men said,
"I am. These guys are just freeloaders."
"Hey," said the woman, "this isn't funny."
Lucas, "You didn't see her here?" They all shook their heads.
"We just got here yesterday. We were gonna hang around until we left for Hayward."
One of the men said,
"You know, she could have gone up to Two Harbors. I ran into Ranger yesterday when I was coming in. He said a bunch of guys were going up there. There's a county fair going on. It's supposed to be pretty good. You can get a job."
"Bet she went there with them," Karen said. "She knows Ranger for sure, and he's a safe guy."
They had no other ideas, but one of the men asked,
"Who do you think killed Henry?"
Lucas said, "We don't know anything for sure, but there's this guy who travels in a caravan." He told them what he knew about Pilot and his group. None of them knew the name. Then ripped a page from his notebook, wrote his cell phone number on it, and said, "Could I give my number to somebody? If you see her, or if you see Pilot?"
A couple of the men shrugged, and Lucas asked, "How about if I wrap it in a 50?
"Shouldn't take money for trying to help Sky," the woman said.
"Give me the number.
If I see her or hear from her or about her, I'll call you."
"You can get phones at bus stations," Letty began. The woman said,
"My mom gave me a cell phone. I don't call anybody but her, but I got it, and I keep it charged up."
"Good," Lucas said. "Listen, the people who killed Henry, they are bad people. They might be killing people for the fun of it. Travelers are natural targets. Nobody knows where you're at, and if you don't show up, nobody worries because they figure you're out traveling. Take care until we figure out what's going on here." They all nodded, and one of the men said, "We'll tell other people we know. If we get enough of us, we ought to be able to spot this guy." "Call us, but don't mess with him," Lucas said. "You could be dealing with the worst kind of crazy." Lucas looked at his watch as they walked away and said, "Two Harbors is only a half hour from here. Maybe we can catch her there." On the way north, Letty asked, "Have you run into any Juggalos?" "I prefer Aerosmith."
"So you know who they are?"
"Sure. Followers of the Insane Clown Posse," Lucas said. "Most of the Juggalos are okay. Unusual, even strange, but okay. They have meetings around the country that they call gatherings. The feds say some Juggalos have formed themselves into a criminal gang. I don't know about those."
"I didn't know the gang part. I'll look them up,"
she said, taking out her iPad. At Two Harbors, they found three travelers, including the one called Ranger, working with a county fair cleanup crew. Ranger said,
"Yeah, I seen her down in Duluth yesterday. She asked me about Henry. Nobody had seen him, and she was talking about going back to the Black Hills. She thinks he might be sitting on a bench at their backup spot."
Lucas told them about Henry. They were visibly shocked, but when he told them about Pilot, Ranger said,
"Hey, that guy was in Duluth. I seen that guy. They were peddling puss."
His eyes clicked over to Letty. "No offense." She shook her head.
"Out of that RV up on the hill by the big mall. Tony and me..."
"Who's Tony?" Lucas asked.
"Just Tony. He's one of us guys. We were walking through there, and this guy seen us and said we could get some puss for $75. They were working it out of an RV. We didn't have $75, and if we did, I wouldn't have spent it on that skanky chick he had. I said no, and we kept on walking. But it was like he knew who we were. I mean, travelers."
"Where's Tony now?" Ranger shrugged.
"He was planning to go over to Hayward for the Juggalo gathering. If he got some money, he could have gone back to the mall. He's kind of a puss hound."
"You think these women could have baited Henry in?" Lucas asked. Ranger shook his head.
"No, Henry was a nice guy, but he was kind of gay."
"Gay?"
"Yeah. He didn't really do nothing about it, but we all knew,"
Ranger said.
"You know, he was like from Texas, cowboy boots and jeans. But sooner or later, he was gonna find out."
Letty looked at Lucas and said,
"Sky kind of hinted at it when I was talking to them in San Francisco. I didn't pick up on it, though."
Lucas asked Ranger, "You think they might have run into Sky?"
"I can't tell you that," he said. "She was dragging around town, looking in all the places that we hang out. We do go up to that mall sometimes, and she probably would have gone up there sooner or later."
"This is not good," Letty said to Lucas.
"If you guys run into Sky, or Tony, or see Pilot, you call me." He gave them his number, written on a page, and this time he did wrap a 50 around it. "Please, don't let it go." On the way back to Duluth, Lucas took a call from Robinson, the L.A. homicide cop. He asked,
Did you see the autopsy photos?
No, I've been on the road, Lucas said.
Okay, well, we've got them. And we got a 9-alarm fire here. The cuts are the same. Same pattern on this kid as they were with Kitty Place. Big knife, slashes start up around the shoulder and then go all the way down the body in one long slash. Right across the face, too. It might not stand up if they got a good defense attorney, but I personally think it's about 99% that it's the same killer. You got a walking nightmare on your hands, my friend.
Did they say if the kid was raped?
That I don't know, Robinson said. All I got were the pictures. They don't have an autopsy report yet.
I'll call them, get the reports for both of us.
You chasing this guy? Robinson asked.
Looking for him.
Send him to South Dakota if you get him. They got the death penalty. Unlike us, they use it.
4. Pilot and the disciples got out of South Dakota in a hurry, traveling in an 8-vehicle caravan spaced out over a mile or two, 12 men, 7 women, leaving Sturgis and the motorcycle rally in the dust. So far, the Great Northern Expedition had been a marginal success. They'd spent 2 weeks in San Francisco buying dope, then headed east to Reno, where they peddled the weed to tourists. They ran into some Colorado competition there, but it wasn't too bad, because the Colorado dope was fairly janky, plus it had tax paid on it, so it couldn't compete on price. Pilot tried to use the money from the weed to step up to cocaine, but good clean coke was hard to find, and they wound up with a small bag of coke and a fat bag of meth. They also lost 2 crew members, Biggie and Daryl, who wandered away one day and never came back. From there, they had taken I-15 north all the way to Butte, Montana, mostly because Pilot didn't like to drive across mountains if he didn't have to. From Butte, taking their time, they'd gone to Dickinson, North Dakota, where they unloaded most of the meth for cash to be sold to the oil field workers, and then they turned south to Sturgis to catch the motorcycle rally. The meth sale in Dickinson had gone well, and they got to Sturgis with more than $20,000 in cash and no dope at all. Pilot spent almost half the cash buying cocaine, and then they'd gone through that. Then they'd gone camping up in the hills, had their fun with Henry, and then they got the fuck out of South Dakota.
"This is sure as hell the long way around," Kristen said, looking out at the Arrow Strait I-90. Pilot said, "Well, we couldn't go back through North Dakota. That cop was on us like holy on the Pope."
"Could have pulled the trigger on him," Kristen said.
"And spend the rest of your life in a hole somewhere," Pilot said. "Those cops are wired for sound and video. We wouldn't have had a chance. Lucky you kept your fucking mouth shut."
They'd been hassled by a North Dakota highway patrolman. He'd been called after an argument about a restaurant bill. They hadn't been moving at the time, so he hadn't been able to give them a ticket, and he was late for dinner, but told them if he saw them driving in his state, they were going to jail. He said,
"I'll get a drug dog on your ass. Lickety-split. We don't care for your sort in North Dakota."
The cop had a good eye. At that point, they'd still had a pound of meth stashed in the RV, and if the cop had pushed a search, he would have gotten both the dope and the money.
"This is not our territory, and we gotta remember that,"
Pilot told his disciples as they crossed the line into South Dakota and set up camp.
"We don't look like these people up here, and they don't like people who look like us. We gotta be careful when we're hauling dope. We gotta keep the dope and the money in different vehicles."
"Hate to be pushed by those fuckers," Kristen said. "Fucking cops. We ought to kill one sometime."
"We will," Pilot said.
As it turned out, South Dakota had been as bad as North Dakota.
Sturgis had almost as many cops as it did bikers, although they tried to stay out of sight. Then they got into the coke, and when they left Sturgis, they had only a little more than $4,000. Pilot had another connection in Wisconsin, hooked into him through a guy they knew in L.A. He could deliver wholesale coke, which they could have retailed for enough to get them back to the West Coast, except that they had blown the money for the coke back in Sturgis. Then there was the whole thing with Henry Fuller. "Maybe had too much fun," Pilot confided to Kristen as they rolled on east. "I wish we'd put a boulder on top of that kid. Hold him down."
"I'm worried about Lane," Kristen said. "I could see her pulling back."
"Well, it was her first time," Pilot said. "If we run into some cop somewhere, she could talk. That's what worries me." Pilot leaned back in the passenger seat, looking out at the gray dirt sails of the Badlands, considering the problem. He said finally,
"She's got that golden pussy. That's what I'd hate to give up."
"Pussy isn't a problem. You said it yourself. Pussy is more common than TV." Pilot yawned and said,
"Think about it."
"We could have a really good time with her," Kristen said. She looked hungry around the eyes.
"I'll think about it," Pilot said.
Kristen could be a little scary. He did think about it, though. What he thought was, if they took Lane off somewhere and cut her up, that could damage morale. The disciples all liked her and might start wondering who was next. He turned his head to take in Kristen. She might be down on Lane because Lane had that golden pussy, and the fact was, Kristen was the assistant principal in the group, the one who kicked ass. If they were going to have fun with anyone, maybe it should be Kristen. That'd probably help morale instead of damaging it. He half-dozed, entertaining himself with fantasies of cutting up Kristen. The fine-woven treachery of the idea turned him on. They'd killed a dozen people now, and the numbers made him feel both powerful and comfortable. Powerful because he could do it and make the others go along, and comfortable because he had done it, and it wouldn't be something he'd miss in life. Most of the victims had been chosen because they were the invisible people in the world. Street people, travelers, illegal aliens. You could stop by a Home Depot early in the morning and pick out anyone you wanted to play with. They'd jump right in the car, and the other wetbacks thought them lucky. He'd made one mistake, though. He'd once acted out of a powerful impulse rather than calculation. He'd been cruising down Sunset, stopped at a light, middle of the day, minding his own business. Okay, a little whacked on Skywalker OG. Then this blonde chick, probably an actress, pulls up behind him in a BMW convertible, top down, sunglasses, red lipstick, white blouse, the whole bit. The light turned green, and swear to God, she honked her horn like one split second after the light changed. He was a little doggy off the line, so what'd she do next? Drop the hammer on the Bimmer and, boom, she was around him like he was a tourist and gone. Pissed him off so badly that he had to hold on to the steering wheel with both hands to keep himself from shaking to pieces. Took it as a sign. The next sacrifice would be a woman. A blonde. Most definitely an actress. They picked her up outside a yoga center on Melrose, hauled her up into the hills. They had a lot of fun with her before she died, begging them not to hurt her anymore. But then... then the shit had hit the fan. They'd been lucky to get out of that one clean. He woke up when Kristen said, "Look at this." They were dropping headlong into a deep, broad river valley with a small town on the far side. "The Mississippi River," Pilot said in his most solemn voice. "The zipper on the United States of America." They went on a bit, and a sign said, "Missouri River."
Kristen glanced at him but didn't correct him. He said, I meant Missouri. But still, it ruined it for him. They stopped on the other side of the Missouri for a root beer and a cheeseburger, then pushed on into the evening across the Minnesota line, camped out overnight at the Walmart Supercenter in Worthington. From Worthington, they went north on Highway 60 and then 71, running up a very long state, and pulled into Bemidji at 2 o'clock on a fine sunny afternoon, ate more cheeseburgers and got some pork chops and beer and potato chips, and headed north again, still on 71, to the intersection of 72, and then north all the way to Highway 11, where they ran out of state.